This is a Pinball News production.
Well, thanks, folks. I got a lot of visual material to cover today, but I thought, well, I better introduce myself too. Although this is pretty informal, I've been doing murals for 30 years, and I painted murals mainly throughout the Western United States, and have been an assistant to many public artists. And my best known work are these giraffes that hold up the freeway and over in the East Bay in Oakland. They're about 30 feet tall, and there's about 7 of them. And that, like they say, you know, the worst thing that can happen to you is to have a big success really early, and that's what happened to me. Anyway, today, before I get going, I wanted to also talk to you about the museum a little bit, in that this year, earlier, you know, I said I have only two priorities this year. One of them is helping the museum to establish, to secure the Richard Conger pinball collection of 1,500 plus games, something, which he has committed to. And the second one was developing a curriculum for what will hopefully eventually become the Pacific Pinball Museum's art department. And in that vein, last year I developed this show, you know, with Robert Indiana and Wayne Thiebaud. And since, you know, I'd been to art school and I'd seen a lot of these paintings already, I thought, you know, well, gee, maybe there are more. So mainly I just went on the internet and found out that there was a bunch of artists who'd been influenced by pinball. And that got me thinking about, you know, kind of the bigger picture. And so I put together the slideshow. You see some selections in the hallway. I'm going to show you more selections of those artists. And then hopefully if there's time, maybe talk about the pinball murals. Also talking about this new direction that I'm seeing that's potentially where the art department for the Pacific Pinball Museum, once it gets underway, where it can go. And just kind of in my spare time, in my spare enjoyment time, you know, that's what I'm doing, is I'm looking at a lot of art and seeing if there's just these little teeny sinews of connection between pinball and jukebox and coin-op and the whole sort of the genre of what was, what used to be common, and for the most part, what is no more. And unless you get into some people's home collections or big shows like this. So, but in this new direction for the art department, I'm seeing four new areas. And one is the whole, there was a box art movement that kind of started way back with Cornell back in the 30s and kind of became mainstream in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Everybody was taking a printer's boxes and putting little shadow boxes inside of it, and it kind of culminated in this big blossoming in Louise Nevelson's work, who, you know, she showed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And so there's the box art, there's sound art that came out, there's kinetic art, and there's machine art. And I brought some examples of those, and all that is just kind of like, I'm just going to take a box and spill them out on the table visually. And I don't really have any, I know there's a connection, but I haven't really put it together kind of intellectually yet. I mean, I know that these things potentially someday can develop into a program for the museum, but I haven't done any work on doing any of that linkage yet. So let me, and I also want to say for the record, back in 2007, I was talking to people. I was going, you know, it would be really, people, we're having this discussion, people were going, what would be a really good game to make? And I said, I think The Wizard of Oz, you know, really should have been made back in the 30s. And, man, wouldn't that be awesome, and just have, you know, Toto in the basket and, you know, the monkeys flying out the game and all that. But anyway. So let's, I'm going to. I'm thrilled. It really is a dream come true. And that it's the movie, it's not the books, which had Dorothy, you know, in California fleeing an earthquake with her cat, you know. So I'm glad they chose to go with the bastardized version. Let's see. I think I want to start with one of my favorites, Robert Indiana. I'm just going to step right over Roy Lichtenstein. I hope there's not any Roy Lichtenstein fans in the room that I'm offending or anything. But I find Robert's work just so much more directly related to pinball art with bumper caps and his whole graphic style. And I'm just going to kind of run through some sort of fast just to let you know, here's this very exciting, interesting artist. And you can see the bumper cap relationship, and he talks about that in his work. Now, he's most famous for this canvas here, the Love canvas, you know, which has appeared on stamps and in sculptures and all over the world. And in Robert Indiana's work, I think I just saw a reference for one of his paintings in, I think, 2001 went for something like $700,000. Not that that should be, like, its value. I mean, its only meaning or its only value, but it is kind of like a high watermark, you know, for something I can consider. He was one of the pop artists, and anyway, just here's some more, you know. But I think you can, especially in this one, you know, that actually just says tilt, you know. I just love that, and. Anyway, this is what I like to do in my spare time. I like to poke around. Here's a picture of Mr. Indiana. Although, God, that's teeny. Sorry about the size of these. A lot of these are just pulled off the internet. But the reason why I put this one up here is if you look at the bumper caps, I mean, these are the kind of bumper caps maybe in the late or in the mid 1940s that he would have been playing on as a child. So you can kind of see that direct correlation. Here's another one of his famous pieces. Take All. Anyway, let's see. Now I'm going to see if I can figure out how to back out of this. Okay. Have people heard of Robert Indiana before? Are they familiar? Is anybody familiar with him? Yeah. Okay. And then this guy here, Wayne Thiebaud. I think we're all familiar. Here's a sample game that Wayne probably played when he was growing up. You know, the common, more graphic image without a whole lot of depictions of people. Again, just these strong, these colors just competing with each other for attention, and the type of type font. Here's a sample of one of his paintings. And I'm just gonna scroll through these just so you have a little bit of a visual dialogue. And there's some interesting notes I made about him. I also call Mr. Robert Indiana Mr. Pop Bumper Caps. Let's see, Jasper Johns and Wayne Thiebaud. He's better known as the painter of pies. He did all these paintings almost as if they were done with a spackle knife. Maybe even a shovel sometimes. He's trying to strike this delicate balance between realism and abstraction. He taught right up in Davis. I don't know if anybody familiar with Wayne Thiebaud's work before? Yeah. He's very well known. And in fact, Sean was telling me one of his paintings was sold at auction through Sotheby's for $3.4 million. One of his pinball paintings, which I thought was particularly interesting. It's more one of the people who he identifies with the blue-collar subject matters from middle-class America. And what he tries to do oftentimes is he's flattening out his subjects. And you'll see the gumballs, in a way, they're almost like little round stickers. They don't have much shadow. They don't have much, a little teeny highlight maybe, but everything is just kind of shoved up against the picture plane as if, you know, you think perhaps is he working from a photograph? Normally if I had a pointer, I'd say, you know, check the edges of, is there a pointer here? Oh, right. Yeah, I would say check, thanks. I'd say just like check these gumballs on the edges and notice how they don't curve around the space. They just kind of lay as if the whole thing has just been mashed right up against everything. Even his ellipses just barely. It's kind of like it's a perfunctory ellipse. It's not really a fully engaging ellipse. But anyway, I love his work, and he's a very optimistic painter. But like I was saying before, he shares a love of vernacular objects, trays and containers and cheeses. And if you see his work in person, his brush strokes are very thick and kind of coming off the surface of the painting. And they almost want to drip down the surface of the painting. And he's represented his whole life through the Allen Stone Gallery of New York from 1962 up until today, I think. But he's more of a still life painter. But a lot of it, if you read about him, a lot of his work is drawn upon his memories of Americana and his boyhood childhood memories. And in fact, I was looking up another one of his paintings, which was like one of the little Safeway horsey rides, and I think it went for $1.6 million recently. And I'd love to include that later on. But if you talk to him, he's satirizing American society, and he's pointing out the kind of the holes in a consumerist society. At the same time, his work is really a celebration. Let me just kind of page through some of his stuff. So this is a typical Wayne Thiebaud painting. But he also did a lot of other work that's just really just super super realist, super fantastic. Here's another one, slot machine. And I think this is one of my favorites, and this kind of relates to, this kind of relates to the whole idea of box art, kinetic art, sound art, machine art. You know, is this a landscape painting? Is this some kind of a machine on a pedestal? Is it contained? It kind of looks like it's contained in glass. It's as if it's doing something. It's just a mystery object, and I could just stare at it for hours. Another one of his. I know. I don't know. But I'm gonna touch on something that I think
it's like a little harp synthesizer.
Oh yeah. Well, I love how it's a mystery. He's presenting us all with a mystery. And here's some more. He really got into the whole gumball machine thing, and I guess he did dozens of these. And then this is a typical Wayne Thiebaud landscape. Here's another one where he has the streets almost looking like where the streets are just stuck up against the picture, as if somebody has a big hinge on one end of it and just puts it up. And he's famous for doing these San Francisco shots. And just because I like his stuff so much, here's another one, and it just becomes these shapes. And here's a picture of Mr. Thiebaud. One more of his little gumballs, but definitely take a look at the edges, how he just surrounds it with almost like a photographic blue on one side and a red on the other, but almost pushing it to an inappropriate level of red. It's so saturated. It's like he's just moved the saturation bar way, way up too high, and yet we love it. And we can't stop looking at it, or at least I can. I just love his work. Okay, I'm gonna. This is just kind of a sampling, of these artists. I'm not getting into any kind of serious biography of his life or these people's lives or work. So let's see. Who do we have here? Anybody want to make a guess? Anybody seen this painting before or no?
Jasper Johns.
You are correct. Thank you. Jasper Johns was concerned with graphics. These are pretty famous paintings. If these ever come up to auction at Sotheby's or whatever, they go in the millions. A lot of these were done in the early 60s and late 50s, early 60s and 70s. I like this one in particular because it's just so, there's something so pinball about it, with a big spinning action and almost, you could almost put a plunger here and just get the extra ball, it's let's see, some more of Mr. John's work. So if you look at this and then you look over here, there's just this, I love that kind of spinning correlation there. It's kind kind of fun. Here he goes again. You're with me, right? I'm having to do this anyway. So this is maybe an example of a game that Jasper Johns might have played as a child. And then later on in life, here you see these big bright colors, a distribution of shapes, with a certain kind of rhythm, much like you would see on a playfield back glass, a layout of sections of geometry put next to one another. So, did you have a question, Ron?
Yeah, what's the primary medium that most of the artists use? Is it oil?
With Johns and Thibault and Robert Indiana, I'm going to say those are oils. I bet that they were oils. I think maybe William Wiley. I'm pretty sure William Wiley did a lot of work in acrylics. So let's jump over to William Wiley's work. Everybody's seen the Only One Earth game that was made from a North Star. But this the quality of line in these is just spectacular. But I wanted, that was one of the frustrating things that I encountered when they did Only One Earth. I thought, nobody asked my opinion, but I really thought it was Wiley's weakest work. And, and then you see something like this, where it's almost borderline overworked. And he's done a lot of paintings that have to do with famous art paintings that have already happened. Ones that are kind of in the, the people are already familiar with. So anyway, so here's his Only One Earth. But he uses a lot of, everybody's familiar with his term pun ball. And how many people have played the machine, his machine, have you? Yeah. So this is more of a typical character of his, the red and white stick over here, the gentleman with the dunce cap, with some kind of a nose affixed to his face, almost like somewhere between a wizard and a magician figure. And you'll see that character showing up in a lot of his
punch character, from
mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's see. But in particular, it's my hypothesis, and I base this on nothing, but I think that William Wiley, as a child, was just somehow so enamored with the work of Roy Parker and the humor of Roy Parker, like that you would see in this Grand Slam back glass, with all these little innuendo jokes and these little kind of insider jokes that I think that affected his humor and his sense of humor later in life in his work. So yes, I've called him a humor thief. So the bare facts, ma'am, joke, and here in Dragonette, again in Four Bells, here's the games of the early 50s that Wiley probably when he was in his teens or early 20s was playing on location. So let's also look at. I'm gonna step over Robert Rauschenberg because I don't think that was a good selection on my part. I think there's maybe some influence, maybe having to do with pinball and Rauschenberg, but I haven't read enough about him. It's just that my intuitive sense is like, I bet there's something there. So I'm just kind of developing that too. Here's George Siegel's work. Has anybody seen his work before? He did this one great piece that I've been trying to find a photo of it, and I haven't yet. And he did a piece. He does these plaster cast figures of people where he'll take hospital bandages and wrap it around the person, let it dry somewhat, crack it off, and reform the object, and then drop it into a movie theater lobby or... Yeah, it's definitely an art reference there. So let me see if I can. So I'll just, again, I'm just going to kind of scroll through some of these, but the one that I'm really looking for is called Gottlieb's Wishing Well, where he has just this kind of downtrodden, sad guy playing a pinball machine, but an actual pinball game is part of the piece. So, and I have this piece. Here's George Siegel. But he's definitely a coin-op guy at heart, I think. This one with a character who's just sitting in the subway, a ticket lady in a ticket booth, or gentleman in a ticket booth. And am I going too fast or too slow? Yeah, I know you're all just feeling tortured because you could potentially be in a room with 375 pinball machines, and instead you're having a dry art lecture experience. So. This is the closest I could find. That's actually the Gottlieb Wishing Well in the background with this shot with George Siegel. So again, if anybody finds it, please send it so you can so it can be included in the lecture.
Can you introduce
them? Oh yeah, sure. Is Darcy here? Or Eric? Or Ed? Oh, okay. Well, then let me introduce Ed Castle, one of the other mural painters. Ed painted... Ed painted the scuba mural, 2001, the wonderful Wonderland piece, and he's definitely one of my inspirations. Thanks again, Ed.
Yep.
Oh, I get nervous at these things.
Dan, what about an outreach to these artists, you know, from the museum where you can put together a package and go to some of these artists or maybe some ones that are not like 90 years old and say, hey, here's your chance to do something either on paper or as a concept for the design of the machine, you know?
You know, I got to tell you, Doug, I'm just pushed to my limit just putting a slideshow together.
Yeah, no,
just
I'm just potential down to, let's say there was an art department someday.
Well, yeah. You know, and I think probably what it's going to amount to is me or whoever going and doing a lot of reading, doing a lot of research, and doing a lot of contacting and probably contacting estates and seeing if you can dig through their archives to find specific references to pinball. Because, you know, my sense of it is I know that that's out there. I know that it was because, you know, in small towns in America, you know, hey, what else was going on, you know? I mean, maybe cartoons, maybe the theater. You know, if you're lucky, you got to go to an amusement park during the summer, you know, and then it's back to the farm and ranching or helping your dad at the gas station, whatever it was. But, you know, I mean, growing up in the 70s was a bleak cultural experience for me. And pinball was my saving entertainment. This is one of my favorite artists here. His name is Ed Kienholz. And Ed Kienholz just seems to know no boundaries whatsoever when it comes to making gigantic installations. And here's a little better color photograph of this work. Him and his wife Nancy made these fantastic pieces. This is probably his most famous piece, called 38 Backseat Dodge. Has anybody ever heard of it? It was at the LA Museum, and it got pulled from the LA Museum because it was so controversial. It has made basically a couple making love in the backseat of this, and there's love taking place in that back seat. It's a very steamy kind of thing, and the LA Museum of Contemporary Art had a poll because they said it was just pornographic, and they actually had the thing, you know, dragged out of there. So but yeah, here's a piece, and the people are like, they're more wire form people. They're just suggestive of people, really.
I remember at the UCR Museum, it was behind a blind, and you had to, like,
oh,
ID.
Oh, man. This is another one of my favorite pieces, called The Beanery, where he had these people with clocks as faces and a guy standing next to a jukebox. You know, and he'd created this little steamy diner piece. It's just fantastic. And then another, I mean, look at the size and the scope of these things. The stories about Kienholz are just staggering. In the hallway, you'll see this piece, the pinball machine with woman's legs affixed also. It was so funny when I was reading about it. one of the guys who helped install it, he got the high score on it. And so he had to have that as part of his of the traveling show, you know. Here he is, just you know. So when you're playing this game, you have to have the legs of the lady wrapped around you as you're playing the game, and it's just obscene to the nth degree.
Her name?
Pardon?
Did that one Gary game?
Let's see. I think that was a ballet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
That's the ballet.
Yeah. Another piece he did. This one is in. He would do these huge installations. He would just take over a room, bring in all this old detritus, all the coin-op stuff, and really just kind of take over a space. And at the same time, yeah, they're pretty hard to take. Here's a picture of Ed in his studio. And so that's just a sampling of.
Where's he live?
Of what? Well, he did live in Montana, and he passed away, unfortunately. His wife, Nancy, they made an agreement that all the sculptures would be called Keenholz, meaning that the two of them, who were so in sync, that the two of them had created these. So so when you see one, everybody just refers to it as a Keenholz. Yeah, they were tied at the hip. And there's this great story about when he passed, they took like an old 49 Dodge and put him inside of it and took the ashes of his dog and put the ashes of the dog and a bottle of Chianti and a couple of dollars and a pack of playing cards, and then they just shoved it into a big hole. And they said that he was set for the afterlife. So it's pretty good. Most people who are into pinball are probably familiar with Charles Bell already, and there's a book on Charles Bell, and a lot of it doesn't include his early work, which you can see the amusement park aspect to his work. Also, here's an old automat. Yeah, so I'm actually not going to say anything about Charles. I mean, his work is fabulous beyond belief. Oops, skipped over. And there's Mel Ramos. If there's somebody that I've got to bring to your attention, I'd love to do that. Mel Ramos and Klaus Ollenberg and Joseph and Richard Estes. Joseph Cornell he's got to be my favorite of all the people who had this sort of a relationship with arcades and with, not so much with pinball, but I think early penny arcades with amusement devices. And when you see his work, it's almost as if you could just stick a coin operation mechanism in them, and they would pay off somehow visually. And it was said that in these, and he made hundreds of them, and they were mainly small, about this big, the same size of a penny arcade machine that you would see. They would actually have some kind of working mechanisms inside of them, and they were meant to be played with by children. But they're considered reverential fine art pieces, and yeah, they go for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and blah blah blah.
But his intent was.
But he was he's probably one of the more intelligent artists. He was extremely well read, and just spent all his time in the theater and the ballet. And but he, like many artists, he had like whole teams of people, helping him. He had something like 160 different collections of old Victoriana in his studio, and he's very much a recluse. And one time he was kind of borderline traumatized by Salvador Dali. He used to do these assemblage films, and he did this one and showed it, and Dali was in the audience, and Dali almost sounded like he physically assaulted Cornell. And Cornell was like, he was very shy, and he just was really kind of, he had this sort of fascination with women like Lauren Bacall, and at the same time he had this fear of women, and so he was never really in a long-term relationship. He ended up taking care of his brother for many years, who had some difficulties. But his work is just fabulous, and a lot of it just directly relates in title to the penny arcade. And he would actually bring home a penny arcade piece of equipment, maybe a ball shooter or something, and he would alter it and play with it and just look at it and consider it. He'd find these objects and go to New York, and he'd go to the oddity shops and the antique shops in New York, and he'd just drag home all this stuff, and then he'd categorize it all, and then he'd pull it out and then put it into these boxes. And he loved birds, and he was just huge on the whole thing with birds. But in terms of the box art connection, he was just decades ahead of anyone else. Maybe Marcel Duchamp was like the only guy who was even considering or thinking of these. And Marcel Duchamp is famous for the urinal that he put in the museum, and everybody had to go consider that as an art piece, a urinal, and it was just groundbreaking at the time. Well, he affected Cornell's work. And Cornell then has this massive kind of like nuclear effect on everybody. All these people, Jasper Johns and all these other people, they just start kind of taking off in Cornell's direction. Well, Cornell was doing these back in the 30s. By maybe 1940 to 45, he's producing pieces like this one here with the birds called Habitat Group for a Shooting Gallery. So here's like, this is the Medici Princess. But it's not just me. Other people can see the relationship. Like if you go to Musée Mécanique and you see the little vignettes, the little tableaus inside of these machines, and you drop a coin and all of a sudden the thing starts moving, or the headman, you know, comes down and he chops off the head of the prisoner in a French, you know, prison or something. So anyway, so this one's called Penny Arcade Portrait of Lauren Bacall. So he probably would have been the first coin op collector, but then, you know, Richard Conger came along. And there's all kinds of other really wonderful paintings. I love this one from 1940. I don't know if you can see that. Yeah. An old WPA era painting. The guy's gambling. It was by Abe Blaschko. Isn't that just amazing? You see the bigger impact that pinball has had, you know. This is more of the early, this is one of the super early pieces that was defined as pop art, and it actually says pop on it, you know, and then it has soda pop in it, so it's kind of interesting. And I love this one. Yeah, and this one's just called Pinball 500, and unfortunately I didn't capture the name of the artist who did this, but now is everybody feeling patient enough? Are you visually stimulated enough? And you can hang in there with me. I'm gonna jump over to this whole new area, and you're gonna see some stuff. This is really exciting, I think. Let's see. What I want to do is just kind of really back up, and this is stuff that you're probably all familiar with, because if you visited Musée Mécanique, you've seen the orchestrions and the music boxes and the and this one in particular, really cool with the little dancing figures down here. You know, with the disc up on top with the music reader here. And, you know, and then in the 1890s with him putting a coin-operated mechanism on it. But I'm just kind of working with this theory that, you know, maybe from 1840s, 1850s, you know, as an extension of the whole watchmaker movement, as an extension of the whole orchestrion movement, you know, that whole genre of these massive mechanical musical instruments is having this sort of this subtle cultural impact. Again, you know, this is an age when there is no drop coin here. You know, here's another piece that perhaps Joseph Cornell might have wanted to take home and alter. So people have seen pictures of these, right, you know, before. This is not new to anybody, I hope. So anyway, but at the same time, I think it's pretty important to know your history, to know what is affecting people in the 1930s who are creating the first pinball machines. And so this is a zoetrope, they're being affected by the box cabinetry, by the mechanical cabinetry, by the sound that these things perhaps are making, and by the kinetic movements inside. And that's something that kind of doesn't get discussed all that much. You know, when people are talking about pinball, they want to know about their extra ball, and they're so into the art of pinball. So I'm just going to start here with the machine art and just kind of run through some of my favorite examples. You know, these are huge pieces, and you can see all this is all part of this one massive sculpture. this piece is called Harmony. These are massive moving sculptures. This one in particular, this is by Jean Tinglue. Does anybody know how to pronounce his name better than me? He's a Swiss artist. This one's really famous, called Homage to New York Destroying Itself, from the early 60s. They put this in a gallery and just kind of set it off, and it just literally destroyed itself through mechanical action.
Whoa.
It was just fantastic. It was a legendary piece, and unfortunately it doesn't get talked about that much anymore. But, yeah, isn't that just incredible? I mean, can you imagine just walking through the park and seeing this? I mean, good Lord. you know, I mean.
Where is that one in the park?
You know, you can look his name up on the internet and find out just tons of information. If you want to just make a note about Jean, that's G-A-N, like Jean Tinguely. I know, isn't it great? I know, I don't know. But I was just, I know, and here's more of a close-up. Look at this, I mean, my God. How can this exist and we not know about it? I mean, I just, I know, isn't it great? Look at that. I mean, just machine, and you can really get that sense of movement in this particular piece. But I'm hoping in the future, you know, that the Pacific Pinball Museum maybe sponsors something having to do with like children building their first machines and you know, robotics and you know, and maybe inspiring them with some of these pieces as a slideshow.
Yeah.
You know, I think that'd be a lot of fun. And here's a picture. And you thought the unibrow was scary, you know. Yeah. Anyway. So, and here's some kinetic art pieces. Or are these box art? No. Let's see. There, some of these, they're kind of genre bending pieces. This one you can see mechanically, it goes off a ball, kind of rolls around. These things now they're commonplace, but
yeah, it's also but, an art
pistol. Right, the, right.
Right.
This is another famous piece of kinetic art, and it's almost based on one of those billboards that move back and forth, and so the piece changes. This is a piece from Burning Man. Again, a piece that deals with movement. And oh, and unfortunately, what's his name? David Falansky. He was sharing. Oh, hey, you didn't have a red shirt on. I was blind to you. And what's this guy's name again?
Barsimian.
Yeah. Now these pieces, unfortunately, I don't have a little film of it, but if you set this into motion, it's a man juggling. And because of the strobe light effect, it looks like the piece is like jumping up and down. But just amazing what you can do with perfect timing.
I actually got a chance to see Barsimian stuff in person, and like some of his pieces would be in this room. This is with his eyes.
Wow.
With some of the stuff.
Wow. This one people may be familiar with, it's a frame piece of art, and because of the mechanism, the frame explodes and then comes back together, and it explodes and comes back together. It's just fantastic. But let's see, Brett Dickens' piece. So again, simplified automata, and here's one, the Condor.
Wow,
not fun. This is a machine that walks, and. That's a lot more common now. This is a piece Mike Sheese might be aware of. Is that Ned Kahn? Looks like one of his pieces where just the action of the wind going across the surfaces with all these little sorts of dangling medallions just ever so slightly rock in the wind, and then just the wave. You can see the waves moving across the surface. And
they're silver, right? And they shine.
Oh, they're just miraculous pieces. Here's another one of Barsamian's work. This is an older book on kinetic art back in the 80s. So anyway, there are these four movements that I'd like to expand and make each one of them a slideshow, you know, for inspiring young people to deal with sound art and kinetic art, machine art, and box art. Now, some of these slides, they weren't really super interesting, so I'm probably not going to show them. This is well known. Anybody recognize the work of Rube Goldberg? Yeah, I didn't know it, but he was better known as a cartoonist, and he did these little cartoons in the papers for years. And he's a very controversial figure, and he had to actually change the name of his children and hide him because he's actually a pretty outspoken activist and advocate. But his name has become synonymous with machines that kind of do simple things with way too much complication. Yeah, this is a piece from Burning Man where the wings just kind of turn around in a circle. But people, you can take it, and it's so much weight, but you can push it with your hand. And it's just fun to play with, and kids just squeal when they get a chance to use it. So anyway... So, you know, I don't know. Just it just struck me as like, gee, include it because it's really cool. You know, I'm gonna jump over box art, although maybe I'll show one or two. But I just love this piece. Yeah, and this is a piece of sound art. When the wind blows, you know, it just makes all these different sorts of whistle noises. It's called Singing Ringing Tree. And I think it's in England, but you can, if you're really interested, you can just look it up and Google it. But you know, I guess my internal hope is, my hypothesis is that all these art movements came after people were already familiar with the workings of pinball machines. The pinball and TV and radio that had all become, had so familiarized people with magic, the magic in a box concept, that that perhaps there's a little thread beneath us all. Like, this is a piece from Blackpool, England, called High Tide Organ. So it works with the power of the tides to make noise.
Do you know about the wave organ?
Yeah, yeah, the Hycopian Gallifer. Yeah, that's a great piece, one of my favorite pieces. Okay, I'm going to step into box art painting really briefly, and then I got one more little thing. So, no preview available. Okay. Well, that might be good. Box art's pretty dry, and everybody's kind of familiar with it already. So. Just going to show just some examples. People already know kind of the look of it visually. You know, these, like I was saying earlier, these things in the 60s, they kind of came and went. But in a way, everybody became a box artist. You could take an old coin-operated piece and put your own little markings on it, and suddenly you were an artist. Lo and behold, you didn't even know you were an artist. And it's funny, you know, when you start looking at too much of this, everything starts to look kind of pinball-related. Yeah. It's like you already have pinball preloaded in your eyes, and you're like, wait a second, that's kind of playfield shape. Hey, those are pinballs. And, you know, and here's a close-up of one of Louise Nevelson's works that she would take these huge, massive wall installations and would, you know, find all these knickknacks and Victorian and pieces of old Victorian houses and cobble them all together and make these kind of stark black-white sorts of contraptions. And then she would just paint the whole thing like a gray. You know, the whole thing was just solid gray. And anyway, here's one more piece of box art. And oh, you can read the inscriptions down there. Good, okay. All right. Now let me see if I can find this one last thing, and then you can all take a nap. Okay, these are just some recent paintings that I found that I just really like. Here's a Robert Bechtel's Foster Freeze with old coin ops on the wall, Alameda, 1970. Yeah, isn't that great? And here's a Ralph Goings' work. I put a little caption in some of these just so I wouldn't have to do it again. Else. And like I was saying earlier, you know, you look at enough artwork and it's like, well, gee, aren't those playfield plastics?
Yeah.
You know, isn't that some kind of movement related to pinball? And I really love this piece of Joseph Stella's work from 1913, Coney Island. You can actually read, you know, Coney Island in here, Coney Island Amusement Park. But it captures the whole excitement and feel and movement of an early amusement park. Yeah, I know it's not pinball related. I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah.
So, and here's a machine art piece, and some of these are a little jumbled up. Here's another kinetic art piece, should be in the kinetic art section, but you think people get the idea, or at least in my mind you're all getting the idea. There's a slot machine piece for men only. Another one of Ralph Goings' paintings, Burger Chef. So, and I'm hoping that people will, you know, enjoy these lectures enough. In fact, I was talking to Gary Stern last night, and he was saying, I've got this piece on my wall, and I'm going to email you a picture of it. And
Charles Bell.
Oh, it was Charles Bell. Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I hope just as all this continues to gather that, you know, it can be a part of the museum's curriculum and influencing another generation, hopefully inspiring kids to know that they're a part of history. And that their what the contribution that they make when they come to the museum, that they understand, you know, the real rich history that pinball has. Now, I'm gonna go off and I'm gonna pontificate for like two or three more sentences, especially since Gary Stern's in the room. And I'm just gonna way wing it, way out on a limb, my dream project is to develop my own game at some point. I would love to do that, but I have to say that I would really love to break what I consider to be the stale format of pinball. Ooh, those are scary words. But I want people to realize that since approximately 1936, there's four elements of pinball that haven't changed. And one of them is, there's been just a stranglehold on the shape of the cabinet. Mm-hmm. It's just dull as dishwater. It's always been the same. And it just seems like we're just stuck with it. Yeah, and I know what I'm saying is like, well, you don't understand the economics of these things. But I'm talking about from the side of the point of view of the art and the artistic direction that pinball could have. The back glass has just always been flat and square. You know, it doesn't have to be that way. You know, especially now that you're making plexiglass, you know, you can have that be a three-dimensional object. I mean, I'm also bringing people's attention to the cabinetry and the legs. You know, steel legs, wood legs. I mean, this is just. Come on, I mean, you know, noises and chimes. I mean, talk about the wasted opportunity that has been for so long. And nobody talks about it, but these are like just four areas that there's, to me, you know, I would be putting guitar strings inside of pinball machines, you know, with pluckers and putting steam whistles, you know, inside of them and police whistles and you have to remember, orchestrions were doing all this stuff 150 years ago. This is not new technology. I'm not proposing anything like, oh, you're just such a radical, Dan. And in fact, you know, I look back on some of those where they were putting like pipe organ pieces and, you know, I mean, they were doing that over 100 years ago. Why can't we have that today? Well, I know it's economics, but I say that just to kind of break the box back open temporarily. And you can put the box back together, but just as long as somebody says the words out loud. So anyway, thanks you guys. Thanks for your patience, and thanks for looking at all the artwork. And thanks again so much to Ron and Martin for putting all this on.
Dandy, do you want to field any questions?
Are you working on any more murals?
Yeah, Mike Sheese has just announced that we're going to do 10 more new murals. Isn't that just incredible?
10 more.
I'm kidding. I'm just kidding. We all want to do them. In fact, there was a lady here from Seattle who just did a big Beat the Clock. So I'm dying to see that. We definitely want to do it. You know, in a way, I think we have to concentrate on the building, you know, and we've got some exciting meetings set up. I wasn't in the seminar when Mike was talking about the future of PPM, so maybe you all know about that more than I do. But there's some very exciting meetings happening, hopefully in the future, that'll secure a lease for a large building, you know, of 40, 50,000 square feet with theaters, cafes, art galleries, classrooms for learning, a whole art department. With its own staff, or I just love this institution that we've built so far. With the support of all you guys, it just becomes more and more legitimate, and more exciting. And the more we discover and kind of recapture pinball's history. And any other questions? The murals or anything? Yeah.
Do you have a favorite sun motif?
A favorite sun motif?
You know, like a starburst or any particular?
No. I mean, I'm sure it's one of those things, like if I sat down, I'd pick out my favorite out of, you know, of all those. But none just comes to mind right now. I'm curious why that question?
I'm working on something. So.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah.
Tell a little bit about the art gallery that's at the museum and some exhibits.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to say something about that, but I was just concerned about time. Yeah, there's been a series of shows at the Pacific Pinball Museum's art gallery, and Melissa and Mike to their credit, in addition to everything else they do, they find artists, they curate shows, they put up... I've had my work shown there. But that's a remarkable achievement. And I think really putting the art together with pinball was the brilliant move. And you see that, I think, with a lot of new businesses from young people now. You'll have a T-shirt shop, and there'll be bingo in the back, you know, on Friday nights or something. Or you'll see house concerts happening in conjunction with the hairdresser's shop, you know.
Is it just like to pinball?
No. I think a lot of the shows are kind of, you know, some are environmental and some are, you know, I think a lot of them have been, you know, pinball or coin-op related. For instance, Melissa's fashion show, the pinball fashion show, that just changed the way I looked at pinball machines. Suddenly it was like, oh, yeah, and how are they dressed? You know, it wasn't. And, you know, and then you'd actually have to look, okay, check their shoes and check their belt and check their purse and check their hairdo and check their hat. And, that, you know, that's never been my experience of pinball. And she, with her show on fashion art, changed the way I view pinball forever. And now when I see, you know, these ladies on the tarmac with their little jet packs and things, you know, it's like, oh, wow, really, really look at that. What would that feel like to be, you know, in some kind of a cowboy outfit and you've got your, you know, bandoleros or whatever, you know. So it's kind of like infusing yourself into those. So
did you guys do a photo montage of that?
She had done research and came up with a narrative and put it on the walls and put some emphasis on different clothing styles from, you know, the Beats to the hippies to the jet setters or the mods or whatever. And it was really, yeah. She actually had it on display here at last year's show. I think it was last year's show too. And it was just, and like I said, you see it and you go, ugh. I'd also just like to put in a really good word for the Richard Conger collection. How many people have seen Richard Conger's, the Silver Ball Ranch? I'm telling you, when you guys see that, it changes you as an American. Because you realize that in the 1930s, you know, he captured so many of those games, like from the 1930s when the chips were down during the Depression. And, you know, here comes American ingenuity in that kind of warehousey back room, let's build them in the attic, boys, kind of feel, you know, when the National Recovery Act was giving small entrepreneurs small amounts of loans at low interest rates or at even non-payback loans to develop companies like Bally. And, you know, and you realize that when you see these games that Richard Conger has saved, you know, he's been collecting since 1952, and when you see them and you realize that's a part of America's heritage, that's a part of our culture and our identity, and it just made me so proud that when things were at their worst, America could be at its most creative moment using hardly any materials, and we're going to do this like on idea power. And Wait till you see that. Wait till the world sees that. And that's why I'm in it. We've got to preserve that. That's got to be shown to the public. Because when the public sees it, this whole thing's going to change. You know, everybody's going to feel real proud again to be an American. Because that's what I got out of it. It was just, yes. And it's just, man, you just get super pinball energy out of that place. It's cool. Anyway, thanks, guys.